Our judge ran harder than I allotted.
We're fine. I've got someone that's really concerned that we're putting stuff, doing stuff off the record. This is just a phone call. So basically, at this point, we're going to go ahead and gavel in. At that time, we'll take your testimony. And if you'd like to continue to listen on, you are more than willing, free to do that. You can also stream it online or stay on the phone. All right?
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and start with the Senate Committee on Judiciary. I'm calling it to order. We have a number of bills that are before us for possible for work session and also public hearing. What we are going to do, because of the availability of one of our witnesses, we will start with Senate Bill 812. I will go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 812.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 812 allows only one motion to disqualify a judge in judicial districts with three or fewer circuit court judges. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. Judge West, thank you very much for joining us. We do have you, as I mentioned prior to going on the record, live, and you can go ahead and give your testimony. Please give us your name before you give us the testimony.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. And thank you, Senators, for this opportunity to testify. My name is Russ West. I'm the presiding judge of Union and Wallowa Counties. We have courthouses in Enterprise and LeGrand. I'm here to testify on behalf of a group of judges who support Senate Bill 812. I'm not representing the Oregon Judicial Department. This bill would apply to the following 12 judicial districts. We have 27 in Oregon. Lake, Baker, and Grant Harney, they each have one judge. Union, Wallowa, Tillamook, and Malheur, they each have two judges. And the following four counties who have three judges: Polk, Lincoln, Crook, Jefferson, Columbia, Clatsop, and Benton counties. I've spoken to nine of the presiding judges of those counties, and they all support this bill. And so that's 10 out of 12 presiding judges, and you had me. And I've been unable to get in touch with two of the presiding judges. One was just recently appointed. Here's the problem. In these small districts, and when I say small, I don't mean geographically, I mean population-wise. In these small districts, we believe we have a judge shopping problem. When two judges get disqualified in a small district, it causes major problems. In my opinion, this bill would improve the quality of justice and improve efficiency in the districts it would apply to. The bill would reduce the number of disqualification motions of trial judges in districts that have three or fewer judges from 2-1. I'm going to explain to you why I don't think one size fits all when it comes to disqualifications. And you're going to hear me talking about double disqualifications. That's where we get into the real problem. The current law allows a litigant to disqualify up to two trial judges if the litigant has a good faith belief the judge is biased against him or her. No specific grounds need to be alleged. Although a judge can challenge the good faith of the defendant, this is seldom done, and I've never heard of it being successful. The law, ORS 14.260, applies equally to large counties like Multnomah and judicial districts like mine with a relatively small population. In medium to large judicial districts, the current law has little impact because there are enough judges available so that a trial judge from within the district can be assigned the case when a defendant exercises both DQs. I obtained stats over a five-year period from my district and from Benton County. In my district, over 5 years, we received 1,100 disqualification motions. Of those, 125 were double DQs. This is approximately 10 to 11% of our disqualifications. In Benton County, in the same five-year period, 714 DQ orders were filed, with 39 cases having two or more DQ motions. It's about 5%. To compound the problem, in these small counties, we often know the litigants or we do business with them. That makes us, we have to, under our ethics, we have to voluntarily step down. The negative impact of the double DQ cases that it has on our court system is significant. Every document that is filed in a case requires staff to seek a judge outside of our jurisdiction to review the case. The more significant impact of the double DQ is the disruption and delay it causes to our docket. The double DQ cases take considerably longer to dispose of because arrangements must be made far in advance for the visiting judge to trade. The delay is unfair to civil litigants as well as both criminal defendants who must continue to abide by their release agreements and to the victims and the public who must wait longer for justice to be dispensed. The double DQ practice has the effect of disenfranchising the voters. Because what happens is the judge who was elected to sit in that district is disqualified. A judge from outside the area, perhaps a retired judge, is brought in. These judges aren't always familiar with the local culture and values and the resources available, for instance, to criminal defendants, drug court, that sort of thing. These visiting judges may not be willing to devote the time and energy to achieve a just result. In the small districts, judges must be brought in from outside the district to handle the case at considerable expense to the taxpayer. In Eastern Oregon, with the considerable distances between the courthouses, the visiting judge is paid mileage per diem and often put up in a motel. And you can just double that because when I have to bring in a judge for my disqualifications, I trade and I travel to that judge's district to handle his or her docket for that day. And let me make it clear, we're not here to support this bill because of fiscal reasons. The reason we're supporting the bill because we think it promotes better justice. I'm providing this just because I know you usually like to know about fiscal impact. I'm going to let my colleague, Judge Branford, talk about the Judicial Code of Conduct, which is a second layer that protects litigants from judges that they perceive to be unfair. There's the Code of Judicial Conduct. We have to follow that. And then there's ORS 14.260. So I'm going to list for you the 17 judges who are supporting it and then take any questions. Myself and Judge Dredke from Union Willow County support it. Judge Baxter, Baker County. Judge Kramer, Harney, Grant County. Judge Patricia Sullivan and Judge Hung from Malheur County, Judge Daniel Ahern, Crook Jefferson, Judge Stephen Reed, Columbia County, Judge Philip Nelson, Clatsop County, Judge Thomas Bradford, and his two colleagues, Judge Sanders and Judge Bockhart of Lincoln County, Judge Locke Williams, Judge Connell, and Judge Donahue of Benton County, Judge Mari Trevino, Kilmer County, and Judge Monty Campbell of Polk County. Thank you for this opportunity to explain why this bill is good for justice, and I look forward to any questions you might have about the bill.
All right. Thank you, Judge West. What I'm going to go ahead and do, since you are all on the line, I'm going to ask my committee if anyone has any questions directly for Judge West. Judge West, it does not appear that there are any questions. I will leave the phone open for you to listen in at this stage if you'd like, or did you need to go on other duties?
No, I'd like to listen in. Thank you, Senator Pozofsky.
All right, thank you. So we're going to ask Judge Branford and Gil Meyer, those are the only two I have listed that want to give testimony, please come forward. And I'm going to allow Judge Branford to go first. And I will have a question. I do want to follow up just to put on the record based on what Judge West says. Judge Branford may cover that question for me.
All right. I'll be available.
Thank you.
Committee members, thank you very much for a chance to speak to you. First, I want to explain that I do not
Judge,
represent.
I do need to put your, ask you to put your name on the record, please.
Sorry. Tom Branford, B-R-A-N-F-O-R-D. I do not represent OJD. I'm just here on behalf of a number of judges who have this feeling from the smaller counties. In my opinion, the integrity of the judicial proceedings is the paramount purpose, the paramount focus here. Life isn't fair. Court needs to be. Court has to be fair. And I think the change we're trying to make here will help improve that goal. This is a good law, and it serves a good purpose. As Clint Eastwood would say, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly. And judges are no exception, and I'm not ruling myself out. If somebody thinks I'm ugly, they should be able to kick me off a case. I have no problem with that. I've been a judge 24 years, and I've been kicked off. I've never kept count, but it doesn't happen very often, but it doesn't offend me. If somebody thinks I can't be fair, I'm off the case. But in those 24 years, I can say that most of the attorneys in Lincoln County have never filed even one affidavit against me on behalf of any client. It is really just a selected few attorneys who do it rather routinely. And it is that process that makes it judge shopping. What makes it a disparate impact in counties of our size is that when they can use two challenges and there's three judges, they know who they're getting. And it's exactly what it is. It's judge shopping. Now, it's entirely different in the big counties because you have no idea who the replacement's going to be. And so I'm not here in any sense to advocate that the rule be changed across the board. Two challenges in a big district, absolutely fine, and it doesn't amount to judge shopping. Couple just recent examples. There's a pending rape case where two guys are accused of raping one young girl. And because there's three judges in our county, one of the defendants challenged Judge Bockhart and Judge Sanders. The other defendant challenged Judge Sanders and me. So they kicked off all three judges, and so we've got to bring in somebody from out, you know, from outside, and then we have to go there. And as Judge West says, the secondary consideration, by far secondary, the fiscal impact, that maneuvering ends up costing the taxpayers money when it shouldn't have to. The statute, Chapter 14, it's, I've got it here. Sets forth certain objective bases where a judge must disqualify himself or herself because they're related or certain circumstances, so you're just out, period. But then in addition to situations where there is at least the appearance of a real bias, the statute allows a defendant or any party, if they simply believe you can't be fair, to kick you off and just say, we can't have a fair trial in front of that person. There's a statute, but then as Judge West alluded, there's also the Code of Judicial Conduct. It too contains, it's 2.1 JR2-106. It requires a judge to disqualify himself or herself with a number of factors where there could instantly be the perception of bias. Just to help underscore the incentive judges have to comply with that. First of all, I think most judges have good integrity. That's been my experience in the ones I've dealt with. But who wants to hire a lawyer to defend yourself when a person has to do is allege they believe you were biased, and that's the way the Judicial Code of Conduct reads? Nobody wants to do that. Just yesterday morning, Judge Sanders recused herself because there could have been a perception in a case that was going to trial yesterday morning, and she didn't find out about it until Tuesday evening. So she took herself off. In another case that's pending, and I have those files here, this is two charges, driving while revoked, and then a hunting offense. Same lawyer, simultaneous charges, different dates. The lawyer says, hey, this is great, Judge Sanders, you can handle the driving case. But in the other case, he files an affidavit of prejudice saying she can't be fair to him. It's so tactical. It's so selective. That's what's offensive. If she can't be fair to him, she can't be fair to him in either case. Why do you get to pick which case the judge is going to sit on? This is a good example of why having two challenges in a small county is wrong. As a native Oregonian, I kind of cringe when I say this. I have some good friends from California, but in California and Washington, only one challenge is allowed, period. And in California, that's the case even if there are multiple parties, plaintiff or defendant. Collectively, they get one. So that Los Angeles or San Francisco or Seattle, one challenge. Why two in Newport? I'm not here to advocate that it be changed across the board again. I'm not saying that at all. I don't represent OJD. These are simply concerns that we have in small counties because of what we've experienced over the years. When I alluded to the Code of Judicial Conduct, I should have said, first of all, because I think most judges do have good integrity, and also because we like our jobs, it's self-policing. There's very much a self-policing going on. In the game case, I had no actual conflict, but my son has hunted with that kid. And so I didn't want to sit on the case with any kind of hint that I might favor him because he and my son have hunted together. So I'm off. And that's just the way judges do it. You don't need two challenges to ensure that proceedings are fair in a small county. The goal is to stop the abuse, to stop the judge shopping in small counties, which I think will promote the integrity of the process and the result for all parties concerned. Judge West alluded to the fact that a judge can try to oppose a challenge filed on behalf of a party, but all the person has to allege is that they have a reasonable belief that you can't be fair. And we have to prove, it's our burden to prove, that they don't have a good faith belief. That's like trying to prove it's not going to rain in 2 weeks. I mean, how can you prove what's in somebody's mind? So effectively, when they file a challenge, it's never disputed by the judge because you can't sustain the burden of proof to say that it's being done for tactical reasons. I guess that's essentially what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much. Gail, why don't you give us your testimony, and then we'll open up for questions.
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Hello there, Judge. This was an amazing little exercise for me. I very frequently send out emails to members and say, okay, here's a bill, it's coming up for hearing. If you have comments, let me know. This was one of those where I got an amazing amount of feedback from practitioners who I can't extract information from for any other reason. But I heard from lawyers who are practicing in Harney, Grant, Lincoln, Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook, Crook, Jefferson, probably others who didn't identify their county. The experience I'm hearing from them is that practicing zealously criminal defense law in a small county year after year after year after year after year after year after year is presents its set of challenges. And they don't exercise these affidavits of prejudice lightly. They know that it does have residual impact. It's like throwing a rock in a pond. It does create after effects. And so it's not something that they do without thought or discretion. Usually what I'm hearing from the lawyers who are telling me their stories is that there is something behind the scene that may not be apparent to the court when they receive the affidavit. So it could be as simple as the fact that they know that that prosecutor, I mean, the judge formerly had been a prosecutor and had prosecuted someone in the defendant's family, and the defendant certainly didn't feel like the defendant felt like he could get a fair trial, or had made previously a bail decision that was contested and felt that perhaps there was always some thinking that had set in, or had been a coach of a victim's father or attended the same church with the state's witness or something of that nature. And sometimes the information comes from the client, not necessarily the lawyer acting on the lawyer's own thoughts. So to be honest, Judge, I think that the members that I heard from would be happy with a one-judge rule in that they feel that it's really important that they have the same abilities to function fairly in the courtroom as their colleagues do in the larger counties. And so in their mind, they weren't analyzing this from a disproportionate impact because of the smaller numbers. 2 out of 3, you can net one choice. I think they felt it more that if folks in a larger county had the ability to do two, that they wanted to do two as well. And they just felt that there was a fairness there with equal abilities.
Okay. Thank you. Questions for anyone on the panel? And we do have Judge West still on the phone. All right. The only thing I guess I wanted to put on the record is that if someone, let's say we went to the one challenge rule, the individual would still have a means to actually, let's say, have the court consider removing themselves or others. Isn't that correct?
Could the person who exercised the challenge could do what, please?
Have a, if we only had the one challenge rule, it's my understanding that that isn't going to preempt them from being able to still challenge a judge. It just isn't going to be as a matter of right to have the challenge done without any real question. I mean, are they doing affidavits thinking that, saying they don't believe that they're going to be able to get a fair trial, but there is another course they could take?
Well, the statute, may I just read part of this?
That's correct. I want this on the record.
Okay. Just a second. A judge shall not, this is in 14.210.1c, a judge shall not act as a judge if the judge is related to any party or to the attorney for any party or to the partner or office associate of any such attorney by consanguinity or affinity within the third degree. The judge shall not act as a judge if the judge has been an attorney in the action, suit, or proceeding. Those are affirmative statutory duties. The Code of Judicial Conduct says a judge shall disqualify himself or herself in a case in which the judge's impartiality reasonably may be questioned, including but not limited to, and then it lists a host of things. If you have a bias or prejudice concerning the party, or if you have personal knowledge of disputed evidentiary facts concerning the proceeding. It was the latter that Judge Sanders took herself off a case yesterday morning because somebody told her something out of court spontaneously. She didn't ask for it. It was volunteered, and she had to kick herself off. If you've previously had a relationship as a lawyer with somebody, if somebody has a financial interest in the controversy, if the judge, the judge's spouse, parent, or child, wherever residing, or other person in the judge's household is a party to the proceeding or an officer, has some interest, there's a separate judicial code of conduct in 2-110. A judge shall not act in a way that the judge knows or reasonably should know would be perceived by a reasonable person as biased or prejudiced toward any of the litigants, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, or members of the public. We have an affirmative duty to take ourselves off a case if somebody could reasonably perceive that we're biased. And that's okay. The onus is on us to comply with this. And so it's an imperative.
Okay, thank you.
Chairperson, I think we just... I was just going to say, I think what you're asking is the affidavit of prejudice that we're talking about in this statute is one in which it's just a good faith belief, but behind that could be an allegation of actual prejudice, and I would agree with you. I think that you could make a claim behind this for actual prejudice.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. But that would be unaffected if there were only one challenge to say, hey, I don't think this person can be fair. The person can still challenge you for actual bias.
Right.
Absolutely.
That's all I want on the record.
And if I could...
Senator Brzozowski, that's what I was going to say, Judge West. You could file party could file a motion to disqualify the judge for actual cause under the due process clause, even after the deadline, even after he or she had used the one challenge if this bill is passed. So
okay.
That can always be done. And we see it occasionally.
All right. Thank you very much. I just want to put that on the record. Gail, you have last say here.
I just have one comment to put on
okay.
The record. I'm not saying my membership wants to go to a one-judge rule. I'm saying that the lawyers who responded to this bill felt very strongly there needed to be a fair number.
I appreciate you having that disclaimer on the record.
Thank you. Thank you. Important.
Can I throw out one just this a final tidbit? The case,
like
the case where... the litigant threw Judge Sanders off because she didn't, it was okay for the driving case, but not for the game case.
Yeah.
So I took myself off. The lawyer challenged both of the other judges.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. All right. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 812? Not seeing anyone, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 812. Judge West, thank you very much. I'm assuming you probably do not want to hear the rest of our hearing.
Well, is the rest of the hearing about Senate Bill 812, or are you moving on to other matters?
We're moving on.
All right. Well, thank you very much, and have a great day.
Thank you very much. Have a great day yourself. All right. So we're going to go ahead and start at the top of the agenda back on there. So I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 566.
And while we're getting ready to read the statement in, I have three people who want to give testimony today: Karen Gunnison, Daryl Fuller, and Alex Kyler. Why don't you three please come up?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 566 authorizes the state medical examiner to establish regions and assume responsibility for county medical examiner duties, declares emergency effective on passage. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. And Karen, did you want to lead off, or did one of the other gentlemen?
For the record, my name is Dr. Karen Gunnison, Chairman Prozanski and committee members. I am your state medical examiner, and I'm here today to give information about how regionalization would occur under Senate Bill 566.
And Doctor, could you just take the microphone and bring it down just a little bit? There we go. Thank you.
First of all, I'd like to, if I can, explain how the current system works. In the current system, ORS 146 divides responsibilities for death investigation between the state and the counties. The state is responsible for all forensic pathology services, including postmortem examinations, toxicology, court testimony, and the teaching of forensic pathology here in Oregon. The counties are responsible for all death scene or local death scene investigation. So actually, the state medical examiner's office has 9 FTE to cover the entire state and give information across the state. The state medical examiner does appoint all county medical examiners. So I would appoint a local doctor in the county to act as a local county medical examiner. They are assisted by the local law enforcement, who are specially trained to be deputy medical examiners. In small counties, these death investigators may only see one or two deaths a year because they don't have that many people. And so it's really their local law enforcement who does this in addition to their other duties as law enforcement. In the large counties or the more populous counties, there are full-time death investigators who are nationally certified and may see well over 100 deaths a year during the course of their duties. Senate Bill 566 would bring all aspects of death investigation here in Oregon under the state medical examiner's office. We would assume all responsibility for every aspect of death investigation. In order to accomplish that, we would form four regions. Each region would be headed by a forensic pathologist who would be the regional medical examiner. Each region would have full-time, state-paid death investigators to cover that region. They would be nationally certified and trained. They would be supported by, of course, the proper tools such as pickups and IT equipment and so forth, so they would be able to carry out their duties from the scene and communicate with the regional medical examiner directly at any given time. While the regional medical examiner would be at the regional center where there would be an autopsy suite and morgue and so forth, these death investigators would be stationed strategically through the region to support or be able to respond to any death scene in a reasonable amount of time. Naturally, we would still expect some support from the local law enforcement. They would be the ones who would contact us or local funeral homes and so forth. But in this way, the state would have full-time experienced death investigators throughout the state rather than just the populous areas.
Thank you. Who wants to go next?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Daryl Fuller on behalf of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I come before you with a strong sense of uncertainty on this bill because we're just not sure where we're at. I do have a meeting with my legislative committee this afternoon, and this is one of the topics of our discussion. I don't know a lot about the process other than I know this has been an ongoing discussion over the last couple of years. We have counties that are in great fiscal distress who probably could use this kind of assistance. We have other counties that may not see the state taking over something that they're currently doing well as a welcome incursion. And so I'm not quite sure where we're going to end up on this bill after today, but I do hope for a little bit of time to work through the issues and to have an opportunity to talk to the folks at the state level because my impression is the state's in as bad a shape as we are financially, and so making sure that the level of service that we have is not diminished at all by removing some of the county authority and moving it up to the state is probably of some concern.
All right.
And I'd be happy to answer any questions, but I just don't know at this point, and I apologize for that.
Let's go ahead and get Alex's testimony, then we'll open up for questions.
Senator Pruszynski and members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I did submit some testimony to the committee yesterday, but wanted to express my thanks to the committee for bringing this issue forward. This is an issue that Lane County is watching quite closely. You may recall Lane County actually last year, about this time, actually sent a letter to the governor suggesting that our fiscal crisis was such that we really did have a question about whether we would be able to continue with some of the state-mandated services. This was after a letter, similar letter, went to the governor from Curry County. And this was primarily due to the well-documented decline in federal forest revenues. There's a couple other factors that have sort of combined: big recession that we've all experienced, and the sort of the structural situation with respects to measures 5 and 50. So in that letter, we described how the county administrator, who's my boss and who builds a budget that she presents to the Board of County Commissioners, much like the governor presents a budget to the legislature, had directed all county departments to put forward a 25% cut package to her in preparation for that budget. And our DA, who has 5 divisions under his authority, actually eliminated the smallest one, which was 2 FTE within the medical examiner's division. And this was a fairly alarming move, but it wasn't all that alarming given the size of the cuts that the administrator had requested. And it was coupled against a sort of calculus that he made with respect to how those services might continue to be provided, in that we do have a state employee who is a deputy medical examiner employed by the state who's assigned to Lane County. So while the death scene investigations would suffer, at least there was somebody there who would continue to be able to perform autopsies and a toxicology report and all that that goes along. And as Dr. Gunson has indicated, Lane County is one of those populous counties. We have over 3,000 deaths a year in Lane County. About a third of those, 1,000, are unattended, and several hundred, 400, actually, just over 400 last year required some additional work in terms of our death scene investigators or the state's deputy medical examiner. And sort of complicating this is that we call our folks deputy MEs as well. So that does, just for the committee's information, can get sort of confusing if you are doing any further talking to counties about who's who. We sort of use the same titles for these people. But at any rate, the board ultimately came up with a way to fund the two people in the office. There was a combination of our senior death investigators leaving employment and as many counties have done, to try to sort of incentivize the more senior folks to take a leave in favor of new employees. So that was one way to save some money. The board also used some one-time funds to fund these. It was about just under $400,000 a year. We used some one-time funds. We actually owed the state some money for a bit of a mix-up over some different transfers back and forth that we were able to negotiate a sort of a better term on and use some of those dollars that we saved. And additionally, we used funds that had been left over in what we'd formed as a nuisance abatement fund. And it was sort of macabre, but the rationale there was that if there's nobody out there to go to attend to a death scene, we would definitely have a nuisance. And so we utilize those dollars. So moving forward, I think the suggestion from Lane County is that, you know, we've been watching this proposal for many years. In fact, it was discussed in the governor's in the task force report on county payments or county services and federal forest payments back in 2009, noting sort of the lack of coverage in the southern part of the state. Also in Lane County, we've got a very sort of undetermined need for a morgue facility. Morgue used to be part of Sacred Heart in downtown Eugene at the campus location. We're now continuing to use the morgue at Sacred Heart as it moved up to Riverbend, but it's not their preferred use, and it's sort of a cobbled together way to move forward. So we like the proposal here. We do recognize the costs, and I think we all have to put that right out there, that there is some significant cost to the system. In the short term, what I would ask the committee is to consider this as one of the county services that is being looked at in the building with respect to counties that are in fiscal distress. As Darrell pointed out, you've got some counties that are okay with how they do things. You've got some, like Lane County, where it became acute very suddenly last year, and it's sort of uncertain how the budget process will evolve this year with respect to those services. I'd ask that the committee get with the folks who are working on House Bill 2206, which deals with assessment and taxation, elections, veteran services, and see if there's a way to include the discussion about medical examiner services and to see if there's some flexibility we can have there. That bill has to do with how it sort of eases sort of some of the technical problems of having the state come in and take over services. My suggestion and my hope is that the committee consider this idea of, in fact, what we did, which was to take some funds that we had and use them in as flexible manner as we could justify. And those were those nuisance abatement funds that originated actually from solid waste fees. And that is the kind of thing that I think counties have been asking for, is if there's a fiscal emergency, how can we use some otherwise dedicated funds for a limited duration of time for some, you know, not all of them necessarily, but some percentage of them. And we've got things like transient room tax, we've got things like solid waste fees, where we could have some flexibility, not unlike how the legislature sweeps funds occasionally when it's in fiscal distress. And we can get through some of these kinds of hiccups as we talk about sort of longer term and structural improvements to the way services are delivered. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. I've got Senator Dingfelder and then Senator Cruz. I just want to put on the record, Alex, your suggestion may be beyond what this bill can do, so I just want to put that on the record, that the relating clause deals with medical examiners.
It's pretty tight.
So,
mm-hmm. Mr. Chair.
Senator Dingfelder.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I notice that three of the five members of this committee are on the bill, so I sort of got it. No, you answered some of my questions, Alex, but one of the things that would be helpful for me is to get a sense of how many, you told me for Lane County, how many deaths per year counties are dealing with, and so if we can get a breakdown for each county, I'm assuming for my county, Multnomah County, it's a much larger figure. I also would be interested to hear from my county medical examiner
Senator Prezanski.
The largest county in
Senator
the...
Senator Dingfelder, I am your county medical examiner.
He's heard from her.
Right. I am actually the county medical examiner for Washington, Multnomah, Clackamas, Benton, Columbia, Morrow, and Wheeler County, Douglas County, because we could not find somebody to take that position in those counties.
Interesting. Okay. So if you can provide that information to the committee, that would be helpful. And then I did note there was not a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so I'm assuming that this would have to go to Ways and Means.
Yes. Yes.
But it is not noticed as such.
Okay.
Senator
Cruz. Yeah. Senator Close.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. We did talk about this. We've been talking about this for several years now as part of how we do the adjustments for counties and, you know, the shared service model and various things. I would suggest that this remain separate, number one, because of the relating clause, but number two, I think sans the money, this is a good idea. I really do, to get some consistency and some better coordination in the way the services are delivered. And I want to thank my good colleagues here for signing on to this bill. This was an option package that did not make the cut with the governor, and I know that. And so we kind of fully fleshed this out. I know, for example, the DA in Coos County says our system is working really good, but I would suggest to Paul that sans county payments, 2 years from now, he may not feel the same way about that. So, I mean, that's just the reality. And when you look at, like, Curry County and Josephine County and the way they're hurting, I'm not sure how else we deliver services. You mentioned Douglas, and we have had a couple incidents that have gone on down there where without somebody there, the death certificate, the coordination is just not there. So, Ms. Chair, I think regardless of budgetary concerns, I like the concept. And it would be my hope, and the reason I drafted the bill was so we could actually have the discussion in the building in the legislature on this. It should have a subsequent referral because there is a whole lot of money tied to this. But it would be my hope, Mr. Chair, that we do send this down to Ways and Means so it can be part of the discussion in the public safety sub as they're looking at allocations.
All right. Thank you. Senator Close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Alex, I just want to ask you at the county level, one concern I have here is the people in the county actually losing services, because if you have one state official that has maybe three or four counties, you know, the family's position is that they want to receive the body as quickly as possible, and that this may delay that, and then that adds cost to them because of preserving the body. If you put together Lynn and Lincoln and Benton, you would go from Hoodoo-Skibo all the way to the coast. That would be the geographic area. And I'm concerned locally that people would experience increasing expenses personally.
Senator Prasansky, Senator Close, if I could answer that. The state medical examiner's office, where we only have six forensic pathologists in the state. The state medical examiner's office covers all the way from the Idaho border to the Pacific Ocean and from Lane County north. And so our policy is to have that case done within 24 hours of death. And we have been able to do that even with that broad jurisdiction that we cover. Currently, we can do that. If we divide it into regions, we would probably be able to do it even better because we wouldn't have to worry about Eastern Oregon, which would probably go to Bend. Since it's not a problem now, I do not see it a problem in the future.
Thank you.
Alex, I'm going to cut this off. I've got another two bills I've got to do. Senator Roblin.
Thank you. I just want to say, because my Coos County, and they are basically a regional now, because they're contracting with, I think, the person in Medford, and then they have their own local person. And this bill wouldn't necessarily say you couldn't have your local investigator.
That's right.
Cruz. So, I've been looking at that, too, and I think because of the stuff that's come up about the ONC counties and what we've been doing, this was a natural for me to be a part of.
Yeah. The bottom line, this is a work in progress. We'll look at it in the future as well. I want to thank all of you for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and open up a new public hearing on Senate Bill 623.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 623 is from the Oregon Law Commission. It adopts new rules clarifying access for court records in adoption cases, creates a segregated adoption summary and segregated information statement, holding the most sensitive information to be filed with the adoption petition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. We have a number of people who want to give testimony, and looking at knowing that this is coming from the Oregon Law Commission, I'm going to ask Lane Shutterly, Wendy Johnson, and who else would you like to come up with you to make a third, or do you not?
They have that arranged how they want to be together.
Okay.
It's not that we don't want them. I think it's that they don't want to be seen with us. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, pleasure to be with you this morning. My name is Lane Shetterly. I'm here today in my capacity as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, just with a few introductory comments on Senate Bill 623. Senate Bill 623 came to us at the Law Commission from the Judicial Department, and in the course of implementing their e-court system, they are looking at the management of court records and through that looking at adoption records and how to coordinate statutes currently on the books with their e-court system and who has access to what records. It came to light that our adoption statutes are nothing short of a mess in terms of providing for clearly who has access to what types of records. It even suggests in the statute that a court may need an order, a court order, to look at its own file in some documents. Clearly, that's not being done around the state, and what's happening, I think, is you have practices that have grown up kind of workarounds, really, as much as anything around the statutes and the way courts manage their records and who has access to what. So that basically that came to us from the Judicial Department to please look at this. And of course, since it involves adoptions, you can imagine that there are passions on all sides about issues surrounding adoptions. We assembled at the Law Commission, I think, one of our largest work groups that we've ever worked with, not only including attorneys and representatives of state and public and private adoption agencies, but also public members representing parents and advocates on all sides of the adoption issue. The makeup of the work group is a footnote on page 5 of the report. And I really want to commend John DiLorenzo, who's a law commissioner and chaired this work group, for having pulled together this disparate group of people and interests and perspectives in a complex area of the law to achieve what is a substantially consensus product in this records bill. There are some other issues in it just besides access to records, but that was the focus of this effort. There will be a continuing work by this work group getting into more substantive issues that you'll be seeing in later legislation next year or in a couple of years. But this is ready to bring forward to you to be enacted now, dealing with the records. So I'll turn it over to Wendy and let her give you the summary of the bill, but I thank you again and commend this bill to you.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz just asked if I could repeat my introductory remarks.
I was going to suggest that.
He missed them.
he'll review the notes afterwards.
Members of the committee, the Dash 2 amendments are before you as well. The Law Commission had the bill filed to meet the filing deadlines, but this work group was continuing to meet. And so, and then the Law Commission had to review the work group's recommendations. And so the Dash 2 amendments before you are the Law Commission and the work group's recommendation. They do gut and stuff the bill. There were enough amendments that it was just too hard to do a traditional amendment. So you have the gut and stuff. I've also provided you the report that Commissioner Shetterly mentioned. This explains the work group's thought process, what we did, what we changed. It goes through each section of the bill, explains the problem and the history of adoption law in Oregon. We've also provided to you ORA 7.211. We provide that to you because the bill repeals that statute, and so you don't have it in front of you. But that is the present adoption record statute. If you take a look at it three times, it says that the records are they should not be expected by the public, but that you need a court order. But it doesn't tell you anything more than that. You need a court order. So that's the law of the land now, that adoption records are confidential, they're sealed, except upon order of the court, and there's no further direction. So the big impetus for this bill was that it's really inefficient, that anytime something gets in the record of the case for an adoption case, the parties, the attorneys, the petitioner, the DHS, who's often involved, they need a court order every time to get something out of that adoption case. So that was why in the e-court system that just didn't work real well, when now the records are going to be electronic. Some are even going to be filed electronically. How is that going to work? You always need a court order. This is really inefficient. It's the only area of practice where you need a court order to access your own records that you put in the file. So that was the real reason. As we got into the project, we recognize that part of the problem is that the adoption statutes are not really clear on what needs to be filed at what time. The petition is the main document in an adoption case, and in that petition you're requesting the court to grant the adoption. You're explaining that you've met the requirements and you have all these attachments and things, but the statutes provide so many times that this must be filed at the time of the petition or this must be filed in the petition. It just wasn't always clear. So now the bill in Section 4 lists out everything that needs to be in the petition. So I'll walk through the sections of the bill, but that kind of gives you the overview of the purpose, was to make sure we could, to see if we could get away from this order requirement. Section 6 says the new rules of those folks who don't need an order every time, and then provides more guidance on what things should be released. So starting with Section 1, that's the definition section of the bill. We're really not changing a lot there. We're just providing terms that are going to be used later in the bill. Section 2 is existing law 109-309, and it's going to list out the filing requirements that you need before you can get a judgment of adoption. And we're sort of reorganizing that and folding the petition requirements into the new Section 4. In Section 4, again, referring to the Dash 2 amendments, the petition requirements are broken down into subsections. The first subsection of subsection 1 of Section 4 has the content requirements of what needs to be in the petition. Subsection 2 has the list of things you need to request the court, otherwise known as the prayer. And subsection 3 lists the exhibits that you need to attach to the petition. So this will make it clear for the court what is going into the file. And what needs to be attached to the petition, so it's part of it. Instead of having lots of different filings, it should be one petition with the exhibits that are required. Subsection 5 has the service requirements for the petition. So it's just one nice standalone statute. It's not a form. We talked about putting a form for the petition, but instead it's a list, so attorneys can continue their practice. But this list of the requirements, really, we worked using the bar CLE, and we had several adoption attorneys. This reflects best practice of how to do a petition, and now it will be more uniform across the state. The bill also makes clear what's not to be in the petition, and the work really, we started with this huge binder. These are all the forms that are filed in an adoption case, and we sorted through them all and decided, okay, there are three documents that really should not be treated the same, that they are the most sensitive in a case, and those are the home study, the medical history, and the adoption report. The adoption report has all of the contact information. The home study has all the financial information and siblings and family member information. And the medical history, of course, has that of the family as well as the child. Those three documents are required in every case, and they're the most sensitive. And so we decided to say, okay, those documents are exhibits, but they should not be put with the petition. They'll be filed separately with what we're calling an ACES, an adoption summary statement. So that is a document that DHS uses a lot to keep everything organized of who the parties are and their contact information. Sometimes the court could benefit from such a nice summary as well. And so instead of having two of these floating around, we'll have one summary with these three most confidential pieces of information. This will be used as a tool for the courts because right now everything's just in one file and it's not particularly organized, and this will segregate those going forward. When you get to Section 6 of the bill, we use those three pieces of information in the summary. We treat those differently and don't allow access to certain persons. So getting at Section 6, the work group discussed the court order requirement and decided that there really are several people who should not have to get a court order, specifically the judge and the court staff, petitioners, attorneys of record for the petitioners, and DHS should always have access to the adoption record in a case. It doesn't make any sense to have to get a court order. They get those records when they ask for the court order, and it's just a waste of time. So Section 6 sub 3 provides that this group of people will have access both pre-judgment and post-judgment to the file. DHS needs it post-judgment to continue their adoption services and child welfare services. So again, it's the judge and the court staff, petitioners, attorneys of record, for petitioners and DHS will always have access. Then moving on to Section 6, sub 4 of the bill provides that the adoptee, when they become 18 years of age, will also have access to the record. with one exception, and that's the home study. This does reflect a change in practice in some counties. Again, you have to file a motion with the court, and you may or may not get those records. And so this would provide a new standard in Oregon requiring access to the file for the adoptee when they reach 18. This was not an easy decision because it is a change in practice for some counties, but the work group felt that this is in line with the Oregon Constitution, which is our Article 1, Section 10, that we're an open court. We don't operate in secret. And in Oregon, the voters have already agreed that these adoptees should get their original birth certificate. And so it just made sense. So why don't they get the original file? They also are already getting, by statute, required to get their medical history. And so this provision would allow them to get the file, the original file, with the court, with the exception of the home study. And the reason the work group decided against the home study is that it has the financial information and a lot of information about their new family, and we did not want that chilling effect that may have on adoptive parents. And with that home study, they could do a motion and for good cause even get that home study, but that would not be an automatic. It would be up to the discretion of the court. Then moving on to Section 6, Sub 5 of the bill, we address those who are required to give consent in the adoption. That's usually the birth parents. The bill would continue basically present law of having to do a motion to the court, but the presumption would be that these birth parents are those who had to give consent. If the birth parent had passed away, there could be a guardian or such that had given the consent. The presumption would be that the records would be provided, but with some exclusions. That summary statement that has all that contact information and those three most sensitive documents, the home study, the adoption report, and the medical history. And the bill provides that good cause would need to be shown to grant a request for the other information that's in the file. So that's essentially providing more guidance to the court. The bill goes on to explain, though, that DHS cases, the parents that are those who are providing consent should be treated differently, and the work group was unanimous that for safety reasons, the birth parents should not be getting that information. Instead, they would also file a motion, but all identifying information would need to be excluded, and the same thing of the summary statement, the home study adoption report, and medical history could not be given as well. In other words, the default is to not provide access in those cases, and also no identifying information. The bill then has a little piece on the use of documents by DHS and state agents or adoption agencies. Present law has been rather perplexing in that regard. It almost sounds like they can't do their job providing continued adoption services and child welfare services in it. So the bill in Section 6 sub 7 makes it explicit that they can, DHS and the adoption agencies can use their adoption records to provide the services that are necessary. Then, so these address specific persons in a case. There will still be a default rule, and that's in Section 6, Sub 8, that if you're not one of those listed persons of the attorneys or the petitioner or the adoptee at reaching age 18, you can still file a motion with the court to get access. So this could be a sibling or a grandparent or something else. We're still using the present default of filing a motion and getting a court order, but we are providing that you need to the court needs to find good cause. Right now there's no standard at all. The work group would like to continue working on that issue of the general access, that default, but we ran out of time to finish that. But there's hope to provide some sort of notice to the parties before access is granted, but that will require more work in trying to figure out some sort of a mechanism to make that happen. But so basically we're kind of towing the line on still requiring a court order, but we would like to work on that further. There's a chart on page 18 of the report that kind of explains how we put this all together. Another important piece is in Section 6, Sub 12, that if the court does provide access, the court is to put a prohibition on redisclosing so that we don't have, so that it's not passed around, that information. If it is provided to a parent or an adoptee, that there would be the presumption of a prohibition on redisclosures because these are most sensitive information and you shouldn't be using another person to end-run the system. So that's in section 612. Basically, it's like a protective order. Section 7 of the bill repeals the existing provisions in 7.211. That's kind of out on in its own chapter. Chapter 7 deals more with courts. Instead, we're putting the adoption records provision in the adoption chapter. And then the bill, also in Section 7, repeals ORS 109.440. That provision, frankly, sounds like you can't talk to anyone about your adoption, and it seems to restrict everyone, and no one understood why it was there, so we repealed it. Section 8 is a sort of a cleanup provision. It's in the dependency code, 419B. In a DHS-type case, you can do a petitionless adoption is what it's called. It's part of the dependency case. And we were required the same ACES, the summary, and those three documents to be segregated in those types of cases in juvenile court as well, so that the file will be the same going forward. Sections 9 through 15 of the bill are really sort of cleanup provisions that I won't go into detail. And then lastly, Section 16 is the operative section of the bill. It would provide prospectively the new filing requirements of what needs to be in the petition and require this new statement of the summary information and those three documents that are segregated. That would be for new cases, but the access rules would go both prospective and retroactively. Again, that wasn't a decision that was taken lightly. We understand that that changes access to adoptions that have already been completed, but the work group did not feel that it was right to wait 18 years for this law to kick in for, you know, many adoptions. It seems to be a necessary step and is in line with changing adoptions. I'll let the adoption attorneys really go into that those policy points, but this really explains what's in the bill.
Okay, thank you. Questions regarding the bill at this point? Wendy, thank you very much for the detailed explanation. It's part of the record and appreciate that.
I was just saying I wish all the bills that were in this good shape when they came to our committee. Thank you for your hard work on this.
Yep. Lane, thank you. Wait, let's see. We got to look like
No, well, you've been here. Thank you for cleaning this up. Now, could you do something about limiting the number of forms that we're required to file in court when we get divorced?
We'll work on
we'll
that.
We'll take that up next session.
Yeah. I mean, quite honestly, having just gone through one and again, I know. This was everybody agreed, but there's so many forms you have to file in the court system, and speaking to my lawyer, he said, I'm not sure why we have to do all this, but we have to do all this. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, I handled my last divorce about 25 years ago, so I'm probably not very well versed to respond to that, but I know Wendy's taking notes.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Lane. All right, we have three other individuals that have signed up for testimony today, Robin Pope, Laura Batt, and then John Whitner. Is there anyone else besides these three that want to give testimony? All right, just to give you a time frame, we have about 20 minutes. I've got two other work sessions I'd like to do today, if possible.
I'll try to move quickly, Chair. Chair Prozanski and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to be here today. My name is Robin Pope. I'm an attorney in private practice, and my practice is focused on adoptions and related matters. I believe you have a copy of my written testimony you received electronically, and I also had hard copies. I have a lot of background in the area of adoption law. I've been doing it for many, many years. I've represented hundreds of birth parents and thousands of adoptive parents, adoption agencies. I've sat on two prior law commission work groups and felt very privileged to be part of this work group. I've also sat on some DHS work groups where we rewrote Oregon administrative rules involving adoption. And what we were able to accomplish with this work group, I'm just very proud of our final product, and with a lot of help from Wendy Johnson and from John DiLorenzo as our chair. I'm not going to read my testimony, but I do want to make some additional comments. I was born in 1953, and when I was born, if you were an adult adoptee in Oregon, you were able to get your original pre-adoption birth certificate. When I was 4 years old, the law changed, and adoption records in Oregon were sealed, as to everyone. And Wendy very aptly outlined who everyone is. we had an era of secrecy in this country, and apparently, as far as adoption went, in Oregon during the 1950s, continuing on into the 1960s, and then the times, they began to change. And we started going out of the 60s into the 70s, and beginning in 1983, Oregon and our legislature here began to make changes in our social policy and changes in our law that started to open up adoption. But it began slowly. We began with the voluntary adoption registry. We went from there in early 1990s to continuing contact agreements, which have been legal in Oregon since 1993. Reflecting that continuing change in social policy and the progression and the belief that openness in adoption was healthier for everyone involved, and in particular for the child, that it would be in the child's best interest to have more information, more contact with all of their family, be it adoptive family or birth family. We then came into 1990s, and in the late 1990s, we had ballot measure 58, and I think we're probably all aware of that. It did ultimately go up to the Court of Appeals. It was affirmed. I believe Justice Muniz wrote the opinion for that. I remember discussing it with him at a meeting one time. He wrote a very well-reasoned, careful opinion as to why ballot measure 58 was constitutional. So now we're back to where we were when I was born 60 years ago. Adult adoptees are able to get their pre-adoption birth certificate. We need to let them have the rest of their history. And that's what this bill in Section 6 accomplishes. It's not a change in policy in Oregon, and it's not even a shift. It's simply that progression, that evolution, and recognition of what we're already doing in Oregon. The bulk of adoptions in Oregon are open. People meet each other. They exchange names, phone numbers, email addresses. In this day of electronic communication, people can find each other even if they don't share that information. So what we're trying to do with this bill is recognize what in reality is already happening, and we encourage you to support that. I want to move to just the practical impact of all the other sections, because I am a practicing attorney. I've served on these various work groups with DHS. I've also sat and continue to sit as a pro tem judge. And the practical impact is that this bill is going to improve the efficiency. It's going to improve it for the courts in particular. It's going to improve it for DHS. And I hope it's going to improve the standard of practice for adoption attorneys in Oregon. I mentor attorneys around the state on a regular basis who don't do a lot of adoption work. I do repair work for the Professional Liability Fund. And I almost always have a case, a repair case. And I would like not to have those repair cases, and the PLF would love it if they didn't have to contact me. So I believe that the sections, I think it's 1 through 5 and 8 through 15, what they do practically, they will improve our practice because they take a mishmash and they pull it all together and say, okay, folks, it's going to be easy to read. You can just go down through this list and you can draw up your petition. And you're going to put everything in here because the statute says it's all going to go in here. Senator Cruz, we're going to be able to reduce the number of documents that we file, at least in adoptions. I used to be a divorce attorney, and I get what you're saying.
Okay.
but we're going to be able to reduce those in adoptions because we have a statute that says, you know, provide verification. Well, why not put that verification in the petition? Why not put this information in the petition? It just makes sense. So what we've ended up with here is a very logical, efficient method of improving what we do in adoptions. And because it's going to be improved and more efficient, and it clarifies, I believe it's going to make it easier for the court. It's going to make it easier for court staff. Over the years, our Adoption Standing Committee has prepared checklists for the tri-county courts, at least. And DHS has adopted some of those checklists, modified them, so that the court staff can go down through and say, did I get this? Did I get this verification, et cetera? We would be able to reduce that amount of work with the way we've set up this bill. In terms of, let's see, the other thing I wanted to talk about is the retroactivity piece. That's a piece that we struggled with on our committee to begin with. And it was very interesting. We took a straw vote at one point, and we ended up doing something other than our straw vote, okay? But when we got to the end and we started drafting this matrix, which John Whitwer, he's the one who had this brainstorm, let's put a matrix up on the board and see who should get what, when. It was amazing how all of a sudden it all came together and we said yes, and we shifted a few things, and then when it came time to actually vote on the matrix, we had consensus, and we had a disparate group of stakeholders. It was impressive. It truly was. So I would ask on behalf of our work group, on behalf of the many, many people I've represented over the years and hope to continue to represent, that you will support our bill and pass it on to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Okay, Chair Przanski and the committee, my name is Laura Batt, and I'm an adopted person, a birth mom, and an adoption professional.
This is Laura's first time testifying.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Take your time.
I was raised in a closed adoption, and I'm very, very fortunate to have connections to the people who have connected me to my biological family. And I don't think it's fair that adopted persons are treated differently than other people. If they were biologically born into their families, they would automatically have their story. And it's even, I understand why people are giving the information at 18, but if you think about it, you have to wait 18 years to find out a part of your story if you were raised in a closed adoption. However, I practice currently, and we're not really doing that. We're doing open adoptions where kids get to know from the start where they come from, good or bad, in between their story, and I feel honored to do that work. I think that we need to give that same experience to people across the board, and so that's why I'm speaking today, and I hope that you consider that and give people access to their stories.
Thank you very much for being here. John?
Thank you very much, Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John Whitwer. I'm a solo practitioner. Well, not as of about 6 months ago, I got a new admittee again for a change. But I've done, I guess my colleague here to the left, Ms. Robin Pope, and I are kind of what we call adoption trench fighters. It's a work of love and of great commitment. As you can tell, there's substantial emotions involved at every aspect. I find myself getting a little teary-eyed here and here speak even, and I have no personal connection with adoption other than it's my life work. In addition to this written statement that I made to you, focusing on two main concepts that the bill accomplishes, ridding barriers for access to adoption records from people where there's no rational reason for that barrier to exist. The existing barriers serve no useful purpose that anyone was able to articulate. I trust there's somebody out there that could come up with a good reason, but it certainly wasn't brought up in the course of this very disparate work group constituency that spoke. And then the streamlining of the practice. I'm kind of an obsessive compulsive guy that likes to dot his I's and cross his T's all the time, and I love this bill. I think this bill is going to improve the practice of law and adoption practice. I think courts, some of the smaller population courts don't see a lot of adoption work, and we are in the education business a lot of times when we're dealing with a judge in those circumstances. The law of adoptions will be better as a result of this bill. I, for one, don't believe that we should make changes just because the wind happens to be blowing that direction. So although I agree that the wind is blowing in the direction of more openness in adoptions, there needs to be a good reason for that, and I believe that that's a justification. It's in the child's best interest that the child have access to that information. We've waited too long to open that door, not just because it seems to be the trend or because most people think that's the way it goes. I believe there's a real sound reason for that. I'd like to point out one aspect of the bill which I think will be particularly helpful to some courts. It's in section, that's on page 20 of the sub 2 bill, of the dash 2. It's in section 8. Dealing with the juvenile court petitionless adoption process. There's been inconsistency in courts in Oregon about how adoptions that are filed as an adjunct to a juvenile court dependency case are treated. Some cases involve the adoption proceeding being tagged on to the end of a juvenile court proceeding. Other courts have been very consistent in establishing a new adoption file for that case and treating it as a standalone adoption. this bill makes it clear that that's how that is to be done, and it should add some consistency throughout the state of Oregon among the courts of this state, so that all the juvenile courts, when they see an adoption petitionless case coming up, they know they've got a new animal. It has different rules than a juvenile court case, and it should be treated as an adoption case. And Section 8, Sub 5 makes that very clear, for which I endorse. So thank you very much for your consideration. I'm available for questions.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for anyone on the panel? Laura, I'm going to close with this and just tell you, I also was born in a closed adoption for myself. And I hear what you're saying. I think it was very important to allow children to have that access sooner than later. I also have to recognize that when those decisions were made by parents, they had an indication of what the law was. And for me, it'd be very difficult to bridge their understanding of what they did for the reasons they did it. I also have been fortunate to meet part of my biological family, which is very good. So with that, is there any other comments? Thank you very much, all of you, for your work on the work group. And this is one of these things why we actually rely so much on the Oregon Law Commission to do so much of this work. As you can imagine, for us to try to take this work on individually as a committee, we would never be able to expedite the work that you can do throughout the year. And so thank you very much for your participation.
You're welcome.
Lane, thank you very much. And Wendy, as always, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
We're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 623. And this bill has a dash 2, which we just received. We cannot work the bill today. I assume that once we get all that stuff together that we'll get it on to the work schedule. More than likely will be for next week.
Next Thursday.
Next Thursday is what we think we'll look at. All right. With that, that concludes the work that we have regarding public hearings. We have two work sessions. I know that there's some questions that have come up with Senate Bill 396, and there are individuals that are here. So I'm opening up a work session on 396. Why don't you give us a brief overview where we're at so we can...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 396 was the bankruptcy bill we heard way back in February 18th, and in front of the committee at the time were various options and various amendments. Those aren't being considered except the original bill. The original bill is the debtor's health savings account, extending the protection for bankruptcy and collection actions to those. There is a dash 4 amendment, which is new to the committee, and that's what people will be discussing today, I believe. This removes the 400 wildcard exemption for inmate trust accounts, and I think there's a representative from Multnomah County DA's office that will explain the reason for that exemption. This is ready to move today with the dash 4 amendments. It has minimal revenue impact and no expenditure impact on fiscal.
Before we open that up, is Lisa Norris and Lampy here?
She just walked out.
Okay, can you go with Lisa? I did not call her.
There she is.
Lisa, I apologize. I see that you have signed up for 623. And did you want to give testimony? I really sincerely apologize that I didn't.
That's okay. No, that's okay.
We can reopen if you need to say anything.
No, that's all right. No,
okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I know we have some individual DLC that are here.
Multnomah County.
Multnomah County.
DA should start off, I believe.
Okay. Whoever. I don't have a...
Jeff.
I don't have a list, so I can't.
Sorry.
The original bill stood that bad. Savings account.
Thank you. Sorry.
That's good.
Thank you. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Jeffrey Rhodes. I'm a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, and I'm here today in support of the Dash 4 amendment to Senate Bill 396. Specifically, this is an amendment that removes, as was said, the wild card exemption from the inmate trust account system. The reason that I am here in support of this amendment is that we have found that this provision has made it nigh impossible for us to garnish inmate trust accounts in order to satisfy outstanding restitution obligations owed to crime victims. And therefore, we're asking that we exempt this amount from inmate trust accounts. And what I'd like to point out to the committee here is that this amendment was never, this provision was never meant to apply to inmate trust accounts, at least by my research to the provision. It just applies by happenstance because this amendment by case law applies to, I'm sorry, I keep saying amendment, this provision applies to cash and cash equivalencies, which is agreed, inmate trust accounts fall under that category. What I want to point out to the committee is that within the Department of Corrections, there are already spending limits that are set on inmate trust accounts, which don't exactly line up with the 18-345-10 $400 exemption. In particular, there is a $150 spending limit, and this is if an inmate has the highest incentive level available to them, they can spend up to $150 a month out of their inmate trust account towards commissary items or other expenditures that they need to make. The provision at issue that we're asking to carve out allows for $400. So what I want to point out to the members of the committee is that even with an inmate that has the highest incentive level, they can never even spend up to the full exemption amount, which just sort of highlights the fact that 18-345-10 doesn't really jive with the inmate trust account system. And just to put some numbers on it, if an inmate with that maximum incentive level of $150 had $150 deposited and spent every single month, they would have $1,800 put in their account and spent a year. And if we have somebody, like a case I'm going to mention in a few minutes, that's incarcerated for life imprisonment, then we could say that would be, if we took 25 years, $45,000 that would be exempt from garnishment under this statute that is currently on the books. All of that would be untouchable by the crime victims, and there would be no recourse for a crime victim. And we've had cases where this has been at issue.
Yeah, I hate to do this. I got 2 minutes left on my time for the committee, and I've got four other people.
Oh, certainly. Well, I can. I believe those are the majority of my position, Chair Brzezinski. I appreciate the time constraints. So I'm available for any questions if the committee has them for me.
All right. I'm going to go ahead and call Mike. Why don't you come on up? And I've got three other people.
Chair, I will yield. Yeah.
And Mary, did you need to testify on this? Mike, go ahead.
Chair Brzezinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee, my name is Michael Gower. I'm the Assistant Director for Operations for the Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide you some information in reference to the -4 amendment to Senate Bill 396. As it stands right now, we do any obligations in reference to creditors and garnishment orders we fulfill, and right now our inmates are under the debtor's exemption interest, personally of property, in reference to not to exceed the $400. This -4 amendment to Senate Bill 396 would remove our inmate trust accounts. This would actually take our inmates away, as the exemption for that. And the concerns that I'd like to bring forward here, that there are a couple ways that the inmates are actually able to put money into their inmates' accounts. One is through our PROS system in reference to work and programs, and secondly is the money that the families actually put into their accounts. And the money that they put into their accounts, they're able to buy on our canteen personal hygiene items. They're able to authorize payments in reference to child support or spousal support, and also permitted at moderate levels, as the Assistant District Attorney stated, in reference to levels of institutional incentive purchases in reference to what they can purchase weekly. Also, in reference to this exemption, there are certain things when you're running a correctional facility you really want to pay attention to, and I learned this 10 years ago when I came in. And there are certain things that we don't want to do in reference to unite our inmate population. And there's activities we monitor in which this might happen, and that would be visitations, mail, food, or their wages. So anytime we're dealing with those things, we always want to make sure, because we don't want them to unite. Under the current practice right now, the Department of Corrections also encourages our inmates, in reference to gaining support either by working or by getting some money put into their books, that they use this money when they are transitioning back into the community, because we know when they're releasing, they have problems with transportation, housing, and medical costs. So we try to set up either savings accounts or guide them in reference to the principles of saving and being prepared to when they actually release from our facility. We believe that the proposed Dash 4 amendments, if enacted, could have unintended consequences in reference to making our prisons a little bit more difficult to be safe for our inmate population and, more importantly, our staff. I'll here sit in front of you today to tell you I think we have some of the safest prisons in the United States, and that is because of the hardworking employees we have and the way we treat and interact with our inmates. I think there's also the way the bill is written, that there would be some, I believe it would affect OIA as well as possibly the sheriff's jails in reference to this Dash amendment.
Mike, thank you very much. Is there any questions for him or Jeff? I don't know, Jeff stepped back. What I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead and close the work session. I wanted to get both of your information on the record. We're going to have some discussions. To me, based on what I'm hearing, there's competing interests here. I mean, it could be from potential for crime victims to child support to multiple things. And I think this is something that I'm not, as chair, ready to move forward without more discussion. So we're not going to be moving this bill at this point, because I think we need to have an opportunity for the committee to actually look at what public policies we need to maintain and ensure that we don't have unintended consequences throughout the system, inside and outside the walls. All right, with that, we're going to close the work session on 396. Colleagues, we are going to go ahead and open up a work session on 463. This should be just a straightforward of moving the bill forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 463, we heard on March 14th. This is the racial and ethnic impact statements that are requested by legislative members for legislation or voters' pamphlets measures. This has a Dash 1 amendment, and it removes the grants awarded to individuals from the scope of the bill, because it's the Criminal Justice Commission and Department of Human Services that are mostly affected by this bill. The Dash 1 has no revenue impact. The Dash 1 has a fiscal impact statement issued. It's an indeterminate fiscal at this point. This does not have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. This is one of the bills that, colleagues, you heard when I was not able to be here. Senator Close was chairing that day. I understand from the testimony that CJC, meaning Criminal Justice Commission, stated they were able to do this work and it was not going to have a significant impact on their ability to do the work. Senator Close, was there anything else that you'd like to put on the record on this one?
No.
And then it looks like we need to take the Dash 1 as an amendment, please.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment into Senate Bill 463.
Senator Close moves the Dash 1 into Senate Bill 463. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 463 to the floor with a defast recommendation.
Senator Close moves Senate Bill 463 as amended by the Dash 1 to the floor with a defast recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Close, would you like to carry this one?
Okay.
All right, and so Senator Close will be our carry. We'll close the work session. Colleagues, thank you very much for staying a little bit over. Tomorrow, remember, we will be meeting starting at 8:30.
With popcorn, right?
We will be in room 50 down in the basement across from the supplies area. 50, 8:30.
So we no popcorn?
We may have some at some point. We are going to have, I believe, the governor leading off, and so if you could be there by 8:25 so we can make sure we're all ready to go, then we can get going.
Okay. There may be some popcorn, there may be some corn.
So. Yeah, exactly. Apples, tomatoes. All right, with that, we're closed and adjourned for the day.